On recent Monday evenings here, for about maybe 5 Mondays or something, I gave a series of talks on the Buddha's teachings on self and not self. And I thought I would give the summary talk. So if people come on Sunday, might be able to hear this also. And if you've been coming on Mondays, I apologize for the repetition. One of the very common things that people know about, I've been around this Buddhist teachings for a while, people commonly know that Buddha taught something about not self, a teaching in Pali called anatta. And there's actually often a lot of teachings on retreats, often a talk on, given on a retreat on anatta, something related to it, anatta, this not self teaching. And so it gets a lot of emphasis. And probably with as much emphasis as it gets as much perplexity. People are often perplexed by it. Even if people have heard the talks on not self for a long time, are perplexed. Sometimes people are annoyed by the teaching. What is this not self thing? I mean, I'm here. You know, what do you mean it's not a self? You know, if I have a itch, I scratch myself. I don't scratch my neighbor. So, and at the same time, because it's emphasized so much, being one of the central, very important insights of Buddhism, you know, it just keeps irritating some people. You know, what's going on here? I don't understand. And one of the more very common forms of kind of tension around this teaching of not self is that in certain currents of Western thought, certainly in psychology and philosophy and different places, the word self is very important, has developed to be a very important word, very important concept. And so you find therapists who are trying to build up the sense of self, to make a strong sense of self for the therapists, for their clients. And then they come to, people come to IMC, both therapists and their clients will come, and they hear teachings about not self, and they're even more perplexed, or they're, you know, maybe they run away because we're teaching not self, and they're paying all this money to learn about them, about being a self. And so someone has to be wrong, right? And it's not uncommon for someone to raise their hand here and say, ask that very question, you know, in therapy, I'm developing a strong sense of self, that's what the project is, and this seems, you know, counter to that, the idea of, you know, discovering that there's not a self, no self. So maybe I'll come back to this at the end of the talk. But what I'd like to suggest is that it might be more productive to start this discussion about self using a different term, and that's to use the term person, which is a much more general term than self. Self, when you use the word myself or defining the self, it's a subjective experience. It's kind of we're discovering, we're going inside to our psychology, to our inner life, to find the self, so-called self. But what is the Buddha's conception of what it means to be a human being? What it means to be a person? And you can ask, that's a different question. If you ask, what's the self, you get one response. But if you get to ask the question, what is it to be a human being, you get a different response. And it's much more general, the idea of being a human being, than the idea of being a self. So let's start with the more general and lay the context by talking about the general before we focus on the particular. Now you could focus, ask the question, what is it to be a human being? But I don't like that question so much because it's so general. It's a very similar question would be, what is it to be a person? What's the Buddhist understanding of personhood? And I like the word person because it's more embodied, it's more immediate. It's more like, when you talk about a person, you're talking about a real person. If human beings are still human, real human beings, I guess, but it just seems like it's such a general category to me. So what's the Buddhist understanding of personhood, what it means to be a person? Now, in different cultures, there are different understandings of what it means to be a person. And some of them are very diametrically opposed. Or not opposed necessarily, but just very different from each other. And occasionally you have clashes because you have different concepts of personhood coming into play. And we have very particular ones here in the West, a series of them, maybe many of them, but there are particular ones here in the West, and the one that's most famous here in America is the notion of individualism, being an individual. There's been a lot of research done on what it means to be happy or psychologically healthy here in the West. I read recently that it turns out a lot of this research, until recently, was done on white males. And so, you know, that's one particular category of types of people. But then if you generalize on that for other people, then you're going to misunderstand them. So now there's a tremendous interest in cross-cultural study of psychology and psychological life, because in different cultures it's very different. Different genders, different, perhaps. So what was it like in ancient India for the Buddha, 2,500 years ago? Very different culture than what we have today. What was their understanding of what it means to be a person? So this is my kind of understanding. As I read, I spent a lot of time reading the teachings of the Buddha and gone back and kind of studied it well. And these are some of the main points that I can think of. One of the very key understandings, maybe the central understanding of a human being, what it is to be a person in this early tradition, is a person is someone who's subject to suffering and to happiness, can experience suffering and happiness, has a capacity for suffering and happiness. Very simple statement, maybe obvious, but that's kind of a foundational piece from which we build the rest of Buddhism. That's a different starting premise than a premise you find elsewhere. Might say that fundamental to what it means to be a human being is that human being is someone who's sinful. It's original sin we carry with us. Another kind of central concept that some people have, some people, even Buddhists have this, is at the core of who we are as human being, the center is we have innate purity or innate beauty or innate goodness. And that's kind of, you know, very contrasts very sharply with the original sin. In the early teachings of the Buddha, the teaching was not about something innate in that kind of way, like some core goodness or core badness, but rather it was focused on a capacity that we all, the human beings, share. And that's the capacity for happiness and the capacity for suffering. Another capacity that we human beings have is that of being in bondage or being free, psychological bondage. That we can tie ourselves up with our fear, our inhibitions, our anger, our greed, in such a way that our heart or our mind or inner life is constricted or held back or weighed down by it. And the words that are sometimes used by the Buddha is the word bondage. We're in bondage. And then in contrast to that, there's a capacity for freedom. Human beings have the capacity, the potential to be free. And free here means that we can drop those bonds that restrict us or limit us or weigh us down, keep the heart contracted or afraid or small. Another the capacity of human beings is to be disintegrated. Disintegration. We have a capacity to be be integrated and whole or integrated or harmonized as a human being, to be have inner or harmony. Or we could be inwardly disharmonized. Disintegrated. The forces within us could be fragmented, going in many different directions. And often we feel that when we sit down to meditate. Common experience to feel our fragmentation, the way the mind is busy, running around, caught up in many different concerns, and the mind is not settled or harmonized on itself. So a human being, a subject, is a being, a species or something that's capable of suffering and happiness, bondage and freedom, and disintegration or integration. The next understanding of human person, what it means to personhood, is that a person is an agent of change. We can make a difference. That how we act in the world makes a difference. Makes a difference particularly for ourselves, and also to some degree in the world around us, that we are moral agents for change, that our actions make a difference. So that's in contrast to some of the ancient Indian teachings that said that human action has no efficacy at all. No matter what you do, it makes no difference because everything's predetermined and everything's just kind of rolling along and all you can do is kind of roll along with it. Nothing you can do. Things are predetermined. Or another idea is that the gods were in charge, and there's nothing you can do except you could appease the gods or make offerings to them, and they could try to do real changes in your life, make things better for you. Another idea is that no matter, you know, something similar, no matter what you do, your happiness and your suffering has nothing to do with your actions and your behavior. So it doesn't matter how you behave, because it's not going to have an impact on yourself. The Buddha's understanding of a person is that a person is a moral agent, is an agent of change, and will experience the consequences of our actions. What you sow, what you reap, what you sow. So human action becomes very important. The human being as an agent of change, as an actor, becomes very important for the teachings of the Buddha. And so much so that if you read something like Dhammapada, you find, as I said in my introduction there, that the it's probably one of the great pieces of spiritual literature, kind of sacred texts of the human beings have produced, that most emphasizes the power of human efficacy, that we the emphasis of being self-reliant. There's no attempt to look outside of ourselves for a savior, for help, for something else, but it really depends on ourselves. And so you could argue, I think, fairly well, that the teachings of the Buddha put sole emphasis on the efficacy of each individual person to make difference for themselves. That's really the agent, the center, the focus of change is on the individual, on ourselves. We can make a difference. As part of that, there's the understanding that human being, human person, can grow and develop. So we can affect change, and part of that change is we can grow and develop ourselves. And so the Buddha had a developmental model for how human beings grow over time, and it's not much different than the way that we now understand children grow developmentally over time. They grow in all kinds of ways, psychologically, emotionally, physically, all kinds of ways. They develop over time, and you see that change, and you don't want to interfere with the growth and development of a child. There's no need to think that growth and development stops at the age of 20 or 21 or whatever, but it goes on throughout life. So we can grow and develop, we can change. And as we change and make change in ourselves and grow and develop, there are different directions we can grow and develop. And it makes a difference what direction you choose to take. If you want to become a better criminal, you can develop that capacity. You can develop that as a strength. You can develop... I recently had something involvement with a particular form of business. I mean, just buying something, small thing, but in that particular line of business, it's my strongest impression that lying to the customer is paramount. And I had to be really on my toes, because every step along the way, I felt I was being lied to. And I had to hold up the contract or the receipt. I had to, say, what about this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and what about this, and this, and this, and then there was a whole discussion about what was going on. And they all looked like innocent. Some of them looked like very innocent mistakes. But it just was bizarre. And I suspect that, and some of them, they seem very good at their business. They developed their capacity of lying, is my impression I had. So we can develop certain capacities. And so the Buddha said that the capacities you develop have a lot to do with what you want to develop, and you should choose carefully how you want to develop yourself. Now, in choosing how we can develop ourselves and how we can grow, and this is kind of a leap of faith, and so far maybe it hasn't been a leap of faith, but here's a little bit of a leap of faith that I don't think is clearly laid out the logic of it. You could make a logical case for it. And the leap of faith is that of all the things a human being can do with their lives, all the ways they can grow and develop, and all the capacities we have, the one capacity that's most worthwhile to develop is liberation. That in fact, that liberation is held up as the ultimate goal for a human being. There are other goals that are worthwhile to pursue, and other goals which are not don't go against the don't work against liberation. Can go along parallel to it, but that the central goal, highest goal, is liberation, to liberate the heart, to liberate the mind, and to become free. And this is sense of liberation, to repeat myself here, is a potential we all have. And in terms of, so it's very important to understand, the human being in Buddhism is understood to have the potential for liberation. That potential could be a potential is could be seen as the innate goodness, if you like that kind of language, but it's not a thing. It is not there unless we act on it and develop it. But it's kind of a potential that's there, capacity. Part of that understanding then leads a little bit to the Buddhist understanding of how to relate to other people. So, our understanding of personhood, what it means to be a person, affects not only how we relate to ourselves, but how we relate to others. How we see other people as people. People, you know, nowadays people have human rights. People have human responsibilities. And so we treat people as people means, for example, we give them certain rights or certain respect or certain kind of, we treat them certain kinds of ways. So how is it the Buddha's, so how is it the Buddha's teachings and understanding of personhood affects how we treat others? One of the central ones is this understanding of our capacity for liberation. That as you see other people, we see other people as having capacity for liberation. We want to respect that capacity in everyone that we meet, and support it. And so that's one of the reasons why Buddhists tend to be against capital punishment, because capital punishment negates the idea that people have the capacity for liberation. You want to respect that, honor it, and encourage it. Also the idea of euthanasia in Buddhism is very much discouraged, generally. What you want to do in Buddhism is you want to help a person stay alive as long as possible within a certain kind of reason, because while they're still a person they have the capacity to develop themselves and move towards liberation, and you don't want to truncate or do anything to limit that growth or that possibility of the human being. And also in the understanding of what it means to be a human being, human person, in others, is there's an emphasis on exchanging self with others in Buddhism. Where if you understand other, try to understand other people as if you're in their shoes, and so we treat people respectfully as if they're ourselves. And this is seen both, kind of, I would say, kind of mythically, in the teaching that. Everybody has been, at some point or other, has been your mother or your father or your sister or your brother or your kid. That does, because this endless cycles of rebirth that goes on, it's going on because it's endless, sooner or later everyone has been a relative of yours, close relatives. So we treat everyone with that kind of respect, as if they were a close relative. The next kind of, last one, the capacity of human beings or potential, what it means to be a human being, in a sense, is a little bit more conventional, has to do with concepts and conventions, a little bit. But that is that the Buddha differentiated between different kinds of people. And so in looking at human beings, the Buddha said you could differentiate. You could see people, there are different kinds of people. And I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? There are men and there are women, there are, you know, different, all kinds of differences we can, tall and short people, all kinds of differences we can make. And most of the differences that people make between people are spiritually insignificant, according to the Buddha. And you find the Buddha was actually, people sometimes refer to him as a revolutionary at his time, because he was critical and worked against many of the usual ways in which people are distinguished back in ancient India. Now we know that the way we distinguish each other, the way we categorize each other or see differences between people, creates a tremendous amount of suffering in this world of ours. And as soon as we say you're that kind of person, the other, you know, then it's possible to discriminate against the other. And so we have a lot of, there's a lot of pain. And I think also in ancient India there was a lot of pain There were different caste, differentiation of different caste systems, different races, different class, all kinds of different differences people had. And the Buddha basically ignored and worked against many of those usual distinctions and was very critical of them. And so, for example, people who were born into a particular caste, like the Brahmins, he would say, he would say, oh, a real Brahmin isn't a Brahmin because they were born a Brahmin. A real Brahmin is someone who is ethically pure, lives an ethical life. So he kind of wiped away the caste system in his eyes that had no meaning. What has meaning is how people behave internally, whether they're ethical. So a real Brahmin is someone who behaves ethically. So how we are internally, our ethical and spiritual life, is how the Buddha preferred to differentiate people. And it makes some sense, right? Because if the Buddha is a doctor, and he was often seen as the great doctor, you want to be, your doctor be able to distinguish between someone who's sick and someone who's well, right? When you show up, the doctor, he or she should be able to see, oh, in fact, you're sick. So the Buddha was able to differentiate and see different kinds of people and see what their condition, spiritual condition was like, so he can give them the medicine, spiritual medicine. And in this differentiation between people, there's one category of people that's called the worthy ones, people who are more worthy than other people. Now this is very difficult to talk about, I think, especially in America where we're supposed to be equal. And I find it a little awkward, but in the ancient world, ancient Buddhism, there are some people who are more worthy than other people. And the word for worthy, used to categorize certain kinds of people, is the word arhat. The word arhat means the worthy ones, a worthy one. An arhat is someone who's become liberated. So a liberated person is a worthy person. And in particular, they're worthy for our respect, for our offerings. We offer them food. Ancient monks were given food. They're worthy. They're to be honored, to be respected. Certain people to be honored and respected for their spiritual attainment and capacity. And there are different degrees of spiritual purification, spiritual development, and that the Buddha differentiated between different degrees, up until the point of being an arhat, a fully enlightened person. So that's kind of some of the basic points of what it means to be a human being in the Buddhist tradition, in the early Buddha teachings of the Buddha. Now, another very important thing I can add to this is that if liberation is a freedom from bondage, a freedom from suffering, then it becomes important to look at suffering. What's the nature of suffering? And when you look at suffering, when you study our suffering, understand what causes suffering, there are many causes of suffering within us. But one of the ones that the Buddha emphasizes the most was a suffering around what can be called selfing, around having self-identity, self-concept, self-image, the way we represent ourselves, how we compare ourselves to other people, to our ideals. That this whole idea of selfing, being a self, is fraught with danger that causes suffering. So one of the common forms of selfing, this activity of the mind, an activity of the mind, it's a doing of the mind, that when the mind begins doing something to create a certain self-concept. So one of the ones is the kind of self that arises when we compare ourselves to others. And so I'm better than that person, or that person's better than me. And there's an infinite number of ways we can compare ourselves to other people. It's called the suffering of conceit. Conceit in Buddhism has to do not just being better than other people, but it has to do with comparing yourself in any kind of way that evaluates yourself as being better or worse than others. I'm better, I'm worse than, So in spiritual circles, it's a sad thing, as you come to a spiritual practice that is helping you to become free, and then as soon as you enter into those circles, once you help you become free, people will assume a new identity. Now I'm supposed to be a good meditator. That's who I'm supposed to be, a good meditator, a good Buddhist. And a good Buddhist never gets angry or something. And so, and then you get angry. And then you didn't used to feel bad about yourself being angry. But now that you're a Buddhist, then you can feel bad about yourself because, oh, I'm not supposed to be that kind of person. I'm supposed to be, you know, a joyful, happy, light person. And so there's a suffering that arises because now we're not living up to our ideals. Or you come to a Buddhist group and you compare yourself to other people. That person's so serene and peaceful. I'm never that way. Therefore, you know, I'm kind of, you know, a bad person or inadequate, or maybe I shouldn't be here, or hope no one notices me, I'll sit in the back. And there is so much suffering in this world. It has to do with comparisons, comparing ourselves to others. So it's a kind of selfing. We don't have to compare ourselves. But it's an activity of the mind. You've never been to IMC before? You didn't even know that you could be a bad meditator. But you come here and suddenly, I'm a bad meditator. And that's, you know, you created a thought, an activity. You've interpreted your life in a certain way that kind of weighs you down. Another form of self, selfing, that the mind, activity of the mind that happens, is around possessions. This is mine. This is mine. So, I mean, the classic thing is often said in meditation centers, is you come, if you say you don't come with your own pillow, but you grab a pillow from up there, and you sit down in a place here. But then after a while you have to go to the bathroom, or your cell phone rings in the middle of the sitting, and you have to go out and answer it and come back. And then you come back, and lo and behold, someone is sitting on your cushion. You know, it wasn't your cushion before you came here. But somehow in coming here, the mind has this activity where it creates a identity, a self, in connection to that pillow. That is my pillow. When you leave here, you're happy to let go of that activity of the mind. It's interpreted as my pillow. But this is my pillow for that time, or my place. And so there's this way we take possession of things. And possession causes a lot of suffering. This isn't who I... And the third kind of selfing that the Buddha emphasized that causes suffering is a selfing that happens when we have a view or an opinion about who I essentially am. So this is not necessarily comparing ourselves to others. But, for example, we could say, this is who I, my true self. I am really, you know, it could be anything. It could be a negative kind of opinion about who I really am. Who I really am is there's original sin. At the core of what it means to be a human being is that human beings are originally bad or sinful, and that's kind of, we hold on to that. Even the idea of that we're originally good at the core, if we cling to that, that idea will also cause suffering. Any kind of idea that we have that this is who I essentially truly am, and we hold on to that as a view, will cause suffering. So there were a lot of views in ancient India about what it means to be a self. So now we're switching from a person to being a self. So, and who am I really? I'm going to try to find my true self. And one of those ideas, one common idea in ancient India was that of a soul. That the core of who we are, who I really am, is my soul. And soul is a Western concept, that the word here is atta. And atta is often translated into English as self with a capital S. But it makes it a little bit easier if we translate it as soul. That somehow at the core of my being, there's a seed of the soul. And then the question is, how can I find what that soul is? And somehow finding the soul, identifying and clarifying it, liberating the soul, is a spiritual endeavor. That's kind of the pre-Buddhist idea. And the Buddha argued that if you try to look for the soul, an essential self, you won't find it anywhere. That nothing in your experience will qualify as the soul. Your body is not the soul. Your feelings are not the soul. Your perceptions are not the soul. Your volitional life, your thoughts, your opinions, views, your mental life is not the soul. Your consciousness is not the soul. All the different things we can experience empirically, none of it qualifies as the soul. So if you can't experience it empirically, is there still a soul that you can't experience but it's there kind of in the background? The Buddha said, He didn't answer that question. What he said is, don't bother with that question. It's a waste of your time. Don't go chasing after some metaphysical idea or belief around the self or the soul. Rather, set yourself free from your bondage. The work of freeing yourself from bondage doesn't depend on knowing what the soul is or what the soul is not. And in fact, if you try to pursue, to discover what the soul is or what the soul is not, or try to answer the question, is there a soul or not a soul, you enter into the world of metaphysics. And there's, once you go in that world, there's no way out. You get lost. So the Buddha's suggestion was, don't get involved in the metaphysics of self, the metaphysics of soul. But rather, stay in the empirical world. Stay in the world you can actually experience and see. And really clarify your life there. Understand there directly. And one of the important things to look at is suffering. Because if we understand suffering, then we can look at the medicine for the suffering and how to overcome the suffering and discover the happiness, the great happiness that comes with liberation. So the self, with a capital S, is a dead-end category, dead-end concept for understanding a person's potential for liberation and for peace and for happiness. And then the last thing here, in the teachings of the Buddha, it seems that the preeminent way of fulfilling our capacity for liberation, for deep inner peace, is through meditation. There are other ways, it's not the only way, but for the Buddha it seems that that was the preeminent way, was through the path of meditation. Somehow in meditation is where we can do the work of developing ourselves and growing. And the growth and development of a person through meditation, through spiritual life, and through spiritual cultivation doesn't leave a person weak, doesn't leave a person kind of not knowing who they are in some kind of way. Rather, spiritual cultivation developed in Buddhism actually develops tremendous inner strength. Someone who becomes freer and freer in Buddhism also is said to become stronger and stronger. So sometimes we hear that the teachings, oh, not self. You're not supposed to be, there's no self, there's not a self, there's not a soul. You're supposed to kind of be nobody, float around, and be empty. It's kind of like sometimes you meet people who kind of take this on as a belief. You know, it hasn't happened in recent years, but in the 70s, I remember people come back from Asia and they learn about Buddhism. There's no self. They think the Buddha's taught there's no self. And so they kind of walk around being a no self. And they feel like no one there. Not no one there in some liberated way, but they're just kind of like, you know, it's kind of irritating to be around them. But as someone who is spiritually developed and no longer caught up in the activity of selfing can actually have tremendously powerful inner capacities. Becomes a great, you know, great strength, great energy, great capacity. So Buddhism, in understanding the human person, emphasizes growth and development, inner strength and development. It's an important part of the path. And it's the strength that we develop that allows us at some point to let go of the deepest clingings that keep the heart in bondage. And one of the deepest clingings is the clinging to self. Whether there is a self or is not a self, that's a different issue than whether we cling to self. And one of the deepest clingings we have is a clinging to self. And you need to be spiritually strong in order to have the capacity to let go of that clinging, to be free. So we don't experience ourselves through the filter of self-concept, self-identity, self-image. And I think it's one of the great things in human life to somehow be able to drop the veils of self-concept, self-image, self-identity, and in a sense almost feel like you become transparent. There's a kind of tremendous peace that's possible when we drop all this activity of selfing. It's like the selfing activity of the mind It's like the rough waves on top of the ocean. And when those waves settle, then the ocean becomes really peaceful, still, quiet. So the mind's waves, when the waves of the mind become quiet, the mind becomes transparent, becomes peaceful. So, I hope that helps with this famous teachings on not-self a little bit. Whenever you hear someone talking about not-self in Buddhism, you might want to back up a little bit and try to understand, you know, the wider context of what it means to be a person first. And then once you have that in place, then you can look at the teaching of not-self or no soul. So we have 5 minutes. Any questions for clarification or comments or protests? Anything? Yes? If you could use the mic. There's some people who can't hear unless we use the mic. And pass it back. It's on now.
Thanks. How is meditation the way... How does meditation work as the foundation of the way to achieve what you've spoken about today? Because I don't remember your exact sentence, but you said something about meditation is the way this all...
It's not the only way, but it seems to be, in the teachings of the Buddha, it seems to be the preeminent way.
And how do... And why?
And why? Maybe the simplest answer is that the clinging that keeps us in bondage happens, it's something we do internally, it's inner life. And so we have to develop the capacity to see the inner life well in order to free ourselves from that suffering. So if you stay busy doing many things or always watching television, you're not going to really see yourself very deeply. So you have to somehow have the capacity to look deeply within. Now when we start looking within, one of the things we discover is that it's very hard to see ourselves clearly unless the mind is still. Unless the mind is concentrated, stabilized. So one of the very important functions of meditation is to stabilize the mind, or develop concentration or focus, center the mind, be centered. And the more still the mind can become, the more concentrated the mind can become, the more clearly it can see. And some of the things that are to be looked at are very hard, maybe impossible to see in a normal street consciousness, the state of the mind we walk around in daily life. So we have to kind of look more deeply, and we need some kind of tool like a magnifying glass to see very deeply, and the concentration is one of those things. So meditation is kind of like a laboratory that allows us to put a magnifying glass or microscope onto our inner life in a very deep way. The other thing to be said about this is that to do this work really well, the deep inner work of looking and letting go of clinging, it requires also having a certain degree of happiness and well-being. And it's very hard, say this way, that meditation is one really wonderful vehicle for developing a reliable sense of inner joy, well-being, and happiness. And the way I use the word reliable is that the happiness of meditation is a happiness which is not dependent on the conditions of the world. So I could be happy if I win the lottery, right? But there's a lot of people who are unhappy every week because most people lose the lottery, right? So we're happy because we get a job or because we have some relationship or we get some nice experience happens. Usually happiness is dependent on the conditions of the world. Meditation is one of the great ways of discovering a kind of happiness or well-being that's not dependent on the conditions of the world. And you need to have that kind of... You need to go through, be stabilized in that kind of sense of well-being in order to be able to look deeply. It's a little bit counter... I don't know if it's counterintuitive or what, but in order for that magnifying glass to work really well, you have to be happy. And meditation is one way of discovering that, the unconditional happiness. There are other ways, but that makes sense, doesn't it? Is there a mic closer by?
You mentioned that the Buddha determined for himself, apparently, that looking into metaphysics was a dead end. Now, was that because he actually wrote about his attempts to look into it and decided it was a dead end, but it was like, you know, his proof was too long to articulate, or he just observed people that looked into it and he seemed to get lost? How did he determine that it was a dead end?
That's a good question, because I can also clarify what I said, what I was saying, and that is that that's my interpretation of the Buddha. He didn't use the word metaphysics, but it seemed like every chance he had to engage in metaphysical discussion, he avoided it. People would ask him, and he would always ask some metaphysical question, like, "What's the true self?" He'd avoid answering those kinds of questions. And he said, you know, he didn't use the word dead end. He used the word that the whole exploration of a self, is there self, is there no self, is a quagmire. You know, he used the word quagmire rather than the word dead end. And now, did he lay out a proof, a philosophical proof, of why metaphysical speculation or speculation on self or is the soul is a dead end? I'm not familiar with that. But what you see, if you read the teachings of the Buddha over and over again, it seems that any time that someone wants to argue something metaphysically, he would say, "Don't bother with that. Don't bother with that." And he went through a whole list of metaphysical beliefs a person could have in relationship to spiritual life, and he would just dismiss them. So maybe that's very unsatisfying for a philosopher. And so what he offered then, which is, I think, somewhat rare in the world, is he offered a spiritual path that seemed to have very little metaphysics as part of it. Now, there is one metaphysical belief that he didn't mention that I would call metaphysical, but Buddhists, you know, the people who believe in metaphysical beliefs don't call them metaphysical. Right? It's like people who believe in myths don't call them myths. And so there's one was the idea of rebirth. And so the idea of rebirth was something built into the teachings of the Buddha. And the idea of liberation for him wasn't just simply liberation from the bonds of suffering here and now, but it was also liberation from the endless cycles of rebirth. Because part of the understanding of a human person is that coming back over and over again as a person, being reborn over and over again, is not a desirable thing to do. It's better to become free and be liberated than to be reborn again and again. And that's a huge leap. Some people can't take that leap. You look dissatisfied. Sometimes it's good to leave dissatisfied. I don't know if you are, but that's probably enough. It's also important to have lunch. Lunch before metaphysics. So I hope this was clarifying. If it wasn't clarifying, if anything, then just forget about the talk. Thank you.